I know it's spring break, and like Shelley said, it's always funny because these are the weeks where I'm like, man, why don't we just shut down the church and everybody go on vacation? Right? But you're here, and I'm here, and I'm excited. I'm so thankful that you are here. Shelley and I, we have missed, and so we started Motion in 2011. This will be our ninth year as a church. In September, we'll celebrate our ninth birthday party. And look, I'm just telling you, we're crazy. Like, we're psychotic about the church. We absolutely love the church. We've missed two Sundays in 9 years. And that's just because we were on a vacation that, like, the way it worked out, we were flying and you know, whatever. You understand what I'm saying, right? So we absolutely love the church. We love being here on Sunday morning. I think, really, it is the best hour of our week. And this is what's so funny. You find in our culture so many people that are like, oh, you know, well, I go to church every once in a while, and, you know, it's cool. I get something out of it sometimes when I go. Sometimes I go, and I don't really get anything out of it. I think you get out of it what you put into it. And here's what's fascinating. I've been in ministry for almost 20 years, and there is not a Sunday that passes or a gathering that goes by that I don't get something out of it. There is always something for us to get. And here's what's the most important aspect of this. It's not always about you, baby. Sometimes we go for the sake of other people. Sometimes there are people that are part of our community that need us to be there for them. And you guys are here, so I'm preaching to the other people that ain't here, right? So sometimes we go not because we feel like it, not because it makes us feel good, but sometimes we go for the sake of other people. Can you put some lights on these beautiful people out here so I can see their faces? Because as it stands, I'm talking to a black hole. Hey! I know y'all been seeing me, but I hadn't been seeing you, so it's good to see you. Hey, so we are continuing our series this week called March Madness. We kicked it off last week. And I overestimated the sports fanhood of this group of people. Because when I decided we were going to do this series called March Madness, I'm like, man, everybody's going to love that. That'll be a lot of fun. And then, like, three of you are March Madness fans. So for the next 4 weeks, you're stuck like Chuck. Because there's five Sundays in March, so we're doing this thing. You're going to be a fan of March Madness by the time we get through it. As a matter of fact, listen, this is what we should do. We should create a bracket. You guys, y'all know how this works. Everybody, you can create a bracket, and you pick your teams that you think you're going to win. You're not that good. Let me just go ahead and let you know. Like, we're going to get destroyed because that thing, it drives you nuts every single time. But we should create one for the whole church, and everybody should make a bracket, and then we can have bragging rights and give out, like, I don't know, really lame prizes for the winners and losers and all of those sorts. Everybody gets a participation trophy because that's the world that we live in. We ain't doing all that. So March Madness, if you don't know what March Madness is, there's a tournament every year. It's a little bitty basketball tournament that generates billions of dollars. No big deal. But the point is to decide who the national champion in college basketball is. And so there's a tournament, 68 teams, because they keep expanding this thing to make more money. It used to be 64. Now they've got two play-in games. And then so 64 teams play, and you whittle it all the way down until you get to the Final Four, and then, you know, the national champion, and you decide who the national champion is. And they call it March Madness because all of these games are played in a relatively short amount of time. There's a ton of games. There is no shortage of entertainment when it comes to basketball and March Madness. So that's what the concept is. And here's what I was thinking about as it relates to us. There are so many things about this tournament, about basketball, about sports in general, that parallel the life of a follower of Jesus and the journey of a follower of Jesus. And last week we kind of talked about, I read an article that said that the tournament, March Madness, costs employers $1.7 billion in lost productivity each year. Because we all hop on our phones and it's so fun. The first day we're all really excited, and then our bracket gets trashed and we're like, nah, I'm not really that interested anyway, you know? And so we lose a lot of money collectively as a society because, you know, we're not being productive. And so last week we talked about the parallel between what we think is productivity and what God thinks is productivity, what we think actually matters and what God thinks actually matters. And we told the story about Bigger Barnes and how this guy, you know, he was accumulating a ton of wealth for himself, but God was not impressed with his philosophy. And God said, hey, you're in trouble because you were not rich toward God. And we talked about what all that meant. It's on podcast. You can check it out. You know, our podcasts are actually on Spotify. That's pretty cool. I thought it was cool. just like I thought March Madness was cool and you guys did not. Good. Thank you. Thank you. Man, that's my guy. Eric Basketball, ladies and gentlemen. Eric Basketball, the one and only. You have to think it's cool. I mean, your name is Eric Basketball. Jeez. So this week, we're going to look at another. This one is kind of an obscure parallel. Next week, I promise we're going to get into some of the more obvious parallels. In fact, the last week, I just want you to know, we're going to talk about, there's a penalty. There's something that you cannot do when you're playing basketball, and it's called, it's a lane violation. It's when you stand, there's a painted area underneath the basket. Everybody familiar with this? And you cannot just go, if you are on offense, you can't just go stand under the basket for more than 3 seconds. It's a penalty. They will, right? And they will call a foul on you for standing in the paint. And so we're going to talk about what that means for us. And I'm really, 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 really excited about that one because that's kind of leading into the Palm Sunday party and Easter and all of that stuff. So we're going to get into some of the specifics, but this one is more of an obscure correlation and connection. And so this week we're going to talk about the word that kind of comes up or stands out to me about this March Madness phrase, and it's the mad part of it. Y'all ever get mad? I feel sorry for y'all. I never, ever, ever, ever get mad. Ever. I'm so peaceful all of the time. Even with my children, I never get upset at my kids. I never get upset when I'm driving down the road. Ever. Ever. I never get upset when I hurt myself and I smash my finger and it looks like I painted. It's not painted. I don't do that. It's naturally painted. Never get upset. I never get mad. Right. Wouldn't that be awesome? I don't know if life would be worth living if you didn't get mad sometimes. Because getting mad just reminds you that, hey, man, I am human. I am here and I need Jesus real bad because I do have a tendency to get real mad, right? And so I was just thinking about the word mad, and here's kind of the connection. We could go a thousand different ways with that, but there was a term it's actually an acronym that was kind of coined or developed in the 1960s, 1962 to be exact, and it's called mutual assured destruction. Mutual assured destruction, mad, right? And so kind of the origin is, it's a military term. So the strategy, we probably aren't familiar with this unless you're a little bit older than you would know. Maybe you were familiar with like the Red Scare and communism and the Cold War and the Soviet Union and the United States and just kind of all of these, you know, different philosophies and fears that were present. So in the 40s during World War II, we had what was called the Manhattan Project. They developed nuclear weapons, right? You guys familiar with this? So as they developed and they get more and more powerful, so what happens is now not only do we have nuclear weapons, but other countries have nuclear weapons. And mad is, it's this philosophy that, hey, I could blow you up, you could blow me up, so let's don't. That's basically what it is. And it's this mutual assured destruction that, hey, I could press a button and you could press a button and that would be the end of all of us, right? And so I kind of just started thinking about this mutual assured destruction and how it applies to our lives. And here's what's so interesting. Y'all know that we have an enemy of our soul. We have an enemy that wants to see our destruction and our demise, right? He wants to see us come to a very unpleasant end. So this is the kind of obscure connection that we see as it relates to us and the madness, right? So we kind of have to go back to the beginning of the story. And so you understand that good is present because evil is present, right? We live in a world that it's full of kind of these conundrums and these contradictions, not contradictions in a bad way, but just kind of different ends of the spectrum, right? We have this so that we have this and that there's balance in the world that we live in. And so in our lives, we have an enemy that would just love to wipe us off the face of the earth, just like we have a God who loves us to the ends of the earth, yeah. Right? So we have these extreme opposites, but it just reminds us that, you know, God has got a bigger plan and a bigger purpose. So the Bible teaches us that there is this ever-present threat to the relationship that God has invited us into. Like, God has created us for a relationship with him, but there is an ever-present threat to that relationship. There is an enemy that wants to see our destruction and our demise. He wants to see us fail, to fall, to stumble, to waller in our pity and our misery, to be failures, right? That's what the enemy wants in our lives. And so there are so many, I don't know what kind of church, it's funny, like different church denominations and persuasions call the devil different things, right? So it depends on, some of them just call him the enemy and they keep it very obscure. And some of them are like Satan, and some are say, you know, they say Lucifer, and others say deceivers of the brethren, the deceiver of the brethren. And then you got the father of lies, right? So many different, you know, aliases for this one dude that just wants to kill you. John chapter 10, verse 10, this is what Jesus said about him. And I love, again, the contrast, right? So John 10, 10 says, the thief, another alias for the enemy, the thief comes only to steal and to kill and to destroy. He wants to see you destroyed. But Jesus said, I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. You see the contrast? Now, I think there are so many things that we could take away from this, because I think what happens so often is we just quote the second part of John 10, 10. That Jesus said that, hey, man, I came for you guys to have life and have a full life, an abundant life. That phrase actually means a real and meaningful and purposeful life. That's kind of the way that it translates. And we leave off the first part, that there is an enemy that wants to see you destroyed, that wants to see you fail every single day. And once we understand that there's an enemy, I think it just gives us leverage, right? It gives us the ability. Now, here's what we do. Sometimes we try to negotiate. Why are you going to negotiate with somebody who wants to destroy you? There is no negotiation to be had, right? Any ground given is ground taken. Anytime that you give up ground to an enemy that wants to destroy you, you are allowing him to slowly to begin to control your life and consume your life. And the end of that is always destruction. Now, the enemy is covert. He is very, very crafty. I don't think he's creative at all. In fact, I think he's an imitator. You know what's interesting? So in 1 Peter, it says the devil roars around like a lion seeking whom he may devour. Like he's always on the prowl looking for somebody who has isolated themselves, because how does a lion attack? A lion waits till somebody is isolated from the pack, and that's when they attack, right? And so he's always on the prowl looking for somebody to devour, but it said he is like a lion. He is not a lion. Jesus is the lion of the tribe of Judah, right? And he's always been trying to imitate, so he's just a big fat as a lion, not a lion, but as a lion. Get your minds out of the gutter, church. Jeez. He's an imitator, but he's crafty, and he is clever, and he's covert. He would never knock on your door, and you open the door. Hey, just FYI, I'm going to try to run your life today. You're like, thanks for the heads up, chief. See you later. It's not how he works. What he does, in order to get us to a place of destruction, he uses tactics, for example, temptation. Right? That's what he wants to see in our life. Ultimately, the enemy's goal in your life is to separate you from God, to remove you from the pack, right? To remove you from the place of your strength. He wants to separate you from God. In order to separate someone from God, there has to be sin introduced. Sin is a wedge between us and God. So to get us to a place of sin, he uses the tactic of temptation. God, that was really good. And you guys just looked at me like I was cray. That's good, right? Let me just remind you, that is good. Okay. Thanks, y'all. Hey, I better stop. I have a tendency, Shelly gets on to me. She's like, you got to stop beating people up. You got to stop doing all that. And I'm just like, well, they don't respond like I want them to. What am I supposed to do? And she's like, what are you, three? Mentally, sometimes. So the thief comes only to steal, to kill, and destroy. And the way that he destroys, again, it's covert, it's crafty, it's clever. It is not this very obvious and clear understanding of what he's trying to do. He works through temptation to get us to a place of sin, because sin separates us from God. That's how he wants to destroy us. And so if that's the case, Why would we negotiate with him? Why would we, you know what, we call it compromise. And so thinking in terms of military, you know, tactic and strategy, compromise is, you know, we are enemies, but I'm going to give you this if you give me this. What does he have that you need? Absolutely nothing. There is nothing that you could give to him, that there's anything that you could receive from him that would justify you giving anything to him. You have all that you need in Jesus, so why are you giving anything to the enemy of your soul? And so we're going to look at, y'all don't want to talk about the sin stuff. Y'all know it is not popular to talk about sin in the world that we live in. Did y'all know that? I don't know if you guys know that. Because we don't even call it sin anymore. Like, you're not even really supposed to say sin in church. You're supposed to say weakness or indiscretion or mistake. How about we stop? I gotta be careful. Sometimes, listen, I was telling somebody last night, I was like, I say things in my head that would incriminate me with my mouth, right? I gotta be real careful. So why don't we just stop saying things are not what they actually are? If a spade is a spade, let's call it a spade, right? And so, like, sin is sin. And that's not a bad thing. That's actually a great thing because we are sinners, it actually positions us to be in need of a Savior. And good news, we've got one. So when we sin, let's look at what this does. And we're going to look at actually a story in the Old Testament, one of the most important figures of the Old Testament, and kind of who also, in many ways, shaped some of our views in the New Testament, Christianity. And so you guys are probably familiar with King David. And what I think you find in David is you find a man who absolutely loved God, like absolutely loved God. In fact, the Bible says that he was a man after God's own heart. Like, he really, really loved God. But you know what he also did? He really, really messed up. I'm sorry, he really, really was weak. He really, really had some indiscretions. He really, really sinned. Like, he really absolutely messed up, dropped the ball, and failed in some situations. And so we're going to look at this, and we're going to look at what happens when you try to negotiate with the enemy, and how you're really, when you do that, you're just inviting madness into your life. So we're going to call this point, "You Mad, Bro?" Again, another reference, right? So I think that David was a brilliant man. In fact, I think that I call him a warrior poet because he really was. He was a warrior who also was a lyricist and a psalmist, and he wrote some of these beautiful psalms and just these pourings out of his heart to God and just worship and praise, and it's such an incredible thing. But then he would kill you. He was a bad dude. This is the guy that fought. We understand the story of David and Goliath, but that was really kind of a small battle compared to some of the other battles that he had, because he's like, why would I be scared of this uncircumcised Philistine? I've already killed a bear and I've already killed a lion. I would rather fight the giant than a bear or a lion. I don't know about you. So, I don't know if you've ever seen the anatomy of a grizzly bear. They are killing machines created to murder. Like, they could hit you with those massive paws three times before you knew what happened, and then you're in three pieces. Bad news. So David had already fought a lion and a bear, so he wasn't scared of a Philistine. He was a warrior, and he was also a poet. And I think David was a brilliant person. But you know what I also know? People who are really smart do some really dumb things when they allow the temptation to turn into sin in their life. And so we're going to look at the life of David, a story in the life of David when this happens. So 2 Samuel chapter 11, verses 1 through 5. We're going to read a lot of verses today. You guys are mature and responsible, so we can do that and get away with it, and you're not going to fall asleep. Right? I don't know. I've only seen somebody fall asleep one time in this church, and I'm pretty sure he was narcoleptic, so it's cool. Like, we stay engaged. You guys do such a tremendous job of that. 2 Samuel chapter 11, verses 1 through 5. In the spring, it's this time of the year, right? Listen to this. At the time when kings go off to war, somebody say, wrong place. David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. So at the time when kings go off to war, David was the king. David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. Somebody say wrong place. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. Now, I read this, and I don't know exactly what the time frame for an evening is, but I'm thinking, you know, 5 to 8, right? Why are you in bed from 5 to 8? Strange. So David got up from his bed because he was at the wrong place and he wasn't being productive in his life, so it gave him too much free time. And when you have all that free time, you start doing really stupid things. When you start walking around without the purpose that God has created you for, when you walk away from the purpose that God has put in your life, you start to do things that lead you to a life of destruction. It's the compromise that you make. You start sacrificing your purpose, and you start taking in these concessions and compromise, and they don't bring anything good in your life. So he was at the wrong place at the wrong time. He was on the roof of the palace. From the roof, he saw a woman bathing. Now, David, smart man, went to the roof. I have a feeling he knew what he was looking for. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. Now here's what's happening here, right? So I think that David, weak moment, right? He went to the roof, knowing what he was looking for. He found what he was looking for. Now, here's what's interesting. Sometimes you see things that you aren't even looking for. That's kind of the world that we live in, right? It's anywhere. Sometimes things pop up. God has given you these advanced defense mechanisms against seeing things that you didn't need to see. They're called eyelids. It's called a forehand. It's called a neck that turns, right? Oh, that felt good. Did y'all hear that? Man, Jesus. I'm pretty sure there's going to be chiropractors in heaven. I'm just convinced of it. So God has given us these defense mechanisms against seeing things that we aren't supposed to see, but David saw what he wanted to see. And you start to see the progression of the temptation and ultimately sin. So he sent someone to find out about her. The man said, she is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. David did not care. David was the king. David was smart man doing really dumb things. Then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. Now, the story is very general, right? It doesn't give us a lot of, it doesn't say if he was like, you know, trying to court her, to entertain her, or if it was mandated. He's the king. He does whatever the king wants to do. So we don't really know the answer to that question. So he slept with her. Now she was purifying herself from her monthly uncleanness. I don't know why it puts that, and it puts it in parentheses. I think there are a couple of philosophies or theories as to why that's in there. The first one, so a ceremonial, if you go back to the Old Testament, they had these ritual cleansing things that they would do. So after a woman went through her time of the month, after it ended, you were unclean for 7 full days. So after the end of 7 days, and so I was reading a commentary that thought, this is way too much information, but we're going here anyway, right? There was one commentary that thought maybe it was interesting to prove the timing, because the closer you get to like the 12 to 14 days after the menstruation period, you're the most fertile, and she was kind of nearing that, because what happens next is then she went back home. The woman conceived and sent word to David saying, I'm pregnant. Yeah, no kidding, right? So David, man, really, really smart man that loved God, is what the Bible tells us, that he was a man after God's own heart. How dumb can you be? Like, how stupid can you be? But this is what happens when we start making compromises and concessions with the enemy, and you start giving in to temptation. Here, the temptation just to look leads to the temptation to inquire a little bit further. Well, who is she? And then that temptation leads to, well, why don't you go see if she'll come to my house, right? Why don't you see if she'll come to the palace and check out my digs, right? Cribs back in the gap. And so she comes, and then, you know, obviously the temptation leads to another temptation, leads to another temptation, leads to full-blown sin. And it would be nutty enough if that's where the story stopped, right? It would be madness if that was all that the story entailed. But there's even more craziness to the story. So David gets Bathsheba pregnant. Now, I've always found it interesting. There could be no correlation whatsoever. Isn't it interesting that her name was Bathsheba and David saw her taking a bath? I don't know why that is. Maybe it's just, y'all, this is how my mind works. I'm just telling you. So this crazy story gets even crazier because David's like, oh, Lord, she pregnant. Smart man. I know what I'm going to do. She's got a husband who's fighting a battle for you, you jackwagon. Uriah is out fighting a battle for King David, who's supposed to be out there fighting with him, but in his weakness decided to stay home. And so Uriah is out on the front lines fighting the battle for Israel. So David, smart man, says, hey, let's bring Uriah home for a vacation. He can spend some time with his wife, and everybody will just think that the baby is his. Smart man. Until you find out that Uriah is a person of character and integrity. And so he gets the invitation from the king. The king's like, hey, Uriah, why don't you take a break? And Uriah's response was, there is no way that I'm leaving my men. These guys who are fighting for our country, I'm not going to leave them out here on the front lines to die while I go home and eat and drink and sleep with my wife. So Uriah's got character. David had none. So David's in a pickle. His plan didn't work. David, smart man, comes up with another plan. So he tells Joab, the commander of his army, and he tells him, he's like, look, here's the deal. This is what I need you to do. I need you to put Uriah in the most dangerous position on the battlefield. Put him on the front lines where there is going to be fire. And then I want you to pull everybody else back so that Uriah is a casualty of war. David has this guy murdered. What? Tell me what this guy did. Nothing. Like, fought for his country. Fought for his people. Fought for his king. And his king's response was to kill him. Sin makes us do some really mad things. Temptation and following that path of temptation leads us to do some stupid things. And I don't care how smart you are. I've seen really, really smart people do really stupid things when sin is in control of their life. And so we're going to look at this story just a little bit further and some of the application that it has to us. Because y'all know that we are not exempt from doing mad things. We are not exempt from falling to temptation, following the path of temptation, falling into sin. We are all tempted, right? There is not one of us that is exempt from temptation. So I think understanding that and also understanding how this whole thing works and the compromises that you do not need to make with the enemy are really important. So the first point is this. We've got 4 points. Three are pretty challenging, and one of them is thank God, right? Y'all good with that? Can I get an amen? Just, I'm begging, right? And you guys are giving it to me. It's cool. The first one is this. It is mad to think that you can be in the wrong place and do the right thing. Oh, snap. It is mad. It is asinine. That's a PG word. Trust me. It's a good word. It is crazy to think that you can be in the wrong place and do the right thing. Like, again, maybe you're a smart person, but if you have bought into that notion, you are doing a dumb thing, even as a smart person. 2 Samuel chapter 11, verse 1, we already read it, but we'll read it again. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with a king's man and the whole Israelite army. David was supposed, at the time when kings go off to war, kings go off to war. And then it says, but David remained in Jerusalem. He stayed at home when he was supposed to be at war. David was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and that led him to do the wrong thing. Yeah. Now, for whatever reason, sometimes I think that we think that we're better than a man after God's own heart, and that we can still put ourselves in the wrong position and do the right thing. Now, here's what I know, and this is easy. This is kind of, you know, an easy target, fodder. Maybe your struggle is like David with lust or temptation. So why are you on the computer late at night all by yourself? Y'all want to talk about the wrong place, right? If that's a struggle for you, if that's something that you deal with, maybe you're the smartest person in the room, but that is the dumbest thing you could possibly do. Why would you put yourself in a position to fail? Why would you put yourself in a position to do the wrong thing? The wrong place leads you to do the wrong things every single time. And it's not even just limited to the place. It's also about the people. I think that David didn't have any accountability. All of his commanders, and I suspect that a lot of his advisors were gone, and he was at the crib by himself. So when he started concocting this harebrained idea, this plan that he was going to follow through and started going through all of these you know, temptations, I don't think he had anybody to talk sense into him. I don't think he had anybody that would step in and say, hey, what are you doing? Right? And we think that encouragement is always like, it's okay, buddy, you're going to be fine. But sometimes an encouragement is, hey, moron, like, you're not that stupid. Don't do it, right? Don't go down this path. Don't go down this wormhole and go to this place of destruction. Like, you're so much better than that. Don't do that. But I don't think that David had anybody in his life at that point that would do that. This is why the places that we go, the people that we keep, the company that we keep, the accountability that we have in our life, and the safeguards that we establish are huge. Man, so important. Because there is not one of us that is above this. There's not one of us that's exempt from this. Matter of fact, I was walking out of the store. I always think it's funny, convenience stores, when you walk out of a convenience store, and they give you a brown bag for my Topo Chico. I swear, it was Topo Chico, right? So I'm walking out of the convenience store yesterday, and I had my Topo Chico and my Boston Old Style peanuts. Yeah, I don't know nothing about that. Man, that'll change your life. Stuff is real. So I'm walking out of the store. Now, it just so happens I was on my way to Lakeport, so I was going down High Street. So I'm kind of on the south, right? And so I'm walking out of the convenience store with a brown bag on the south side. And I'm like, I know what everybody's thinking. They're thinking, oh boy, just got a 40. So this is what I did. Now, this is funny. This is just kind of the irony of the situation. This is the way that I think God works sometimes. In that moment, I was like, I got to get rid of this bag so it doesn't look like the appearance is. For me, it's an accountability thing, right? It's a safeguard that I don't want anybody to even be able to say anything that's not true, right? So I took the bag off, and I was just carrying my Topo Chico and my Boston Old Style peanuts. And sure enough, I get in my car, and I start to leave. And you'll never guess that I saw somebody that I knew. And I'm like, had I kept it in my, you know, pour one out for the homies, right? So the people that we have in our life, the accountability systems that we have, the safeguards that we have, and the places that we go. Have y'all noticed? You guys know this is a guilty pleasure. I love watching, like, the ID channel and some of those mystery, you know. Did you know? Literally every single one starts with, at 2 a.m., she was walking out of a club, all alone, drunk out of her mind, and nobody knows what happened to her. I can tell you what happened to her, right? She was at the wrong place. And we know how stupid that is, but we get to the wrong place in our, sometimes maybe the wrong place for you is an attitude. Oh, Lord, we just went there. So maybe the wrong place for you is a conversation with somebody that you know you ain't supposed to be talking to. Maybe the wrong place for you is going to a place in your mind that you know you shouldn't visit. Y'all know what? This is, we live in a world talking about, let's just call them, we don't want to call things what they actually are. We want to give it a name. So now we've got so many disorders. And so some of us, man, we're so far stuck in our own minds that we struggle. And so maybe you're visiting a place in your mind that you had no business visiting, right? You left that place. God has rescued you from that place. Why are you going back to that place? And so the wrong place will always cause us to do the wrong things. Let's get to the right place. I don't know. Go to church. Like you're doing, right? Like you're doing. You do. So that's the first one. It's mad to think that you can be in the wrong place and do the right thing. The second one is this. It is mad to think that your sin only affects you. Can we be honest? Have you ever thought, this isn't going to hurt anybody else? Has anybody else ever done something like that? Right? Because maybe it's just the thought that you had. Now, I don't know if you know this or not, but thoughts are actually trees in your mind that take root and they plant, and you know what trees do is they grow and they blossom. So those thoughts turn into actions at some point. So that thought that you had that is only going to affect me doesn't only affect you, because then the actions that you take and the attitudes that you have start to affect the other people that God has put in your life. So in this moment of weakness, I suspect David, and we don't know this for sure, but I suspect David is like, well, this is just, it's me, right? This is just, I'm going to walk up here and I'm just going to look. It's not going to affect anybody else. It's just, this is my weakness. This is my indiscretion. And so I'm going to look and it's not going to hurt or affect anybody else. Now you see, as a result of the action and all of the consequences, in fact, like you need to go home and read 2 Samuel chapter 11 and chapter 12 so you can kind of get the whole story, because there's so much more that happens as a result of this. And so David's one little indiscretion, it doesn't just affect him. It ultimately affects Bathsheba, and then it affects Uriah, and then it affects his entire household. Like everyone is affected by the sin in his life. And so maybe you think, oh, it's just a one-time thing. It's not really going to affect anyone. Just think about that, right? Because how many times, what's the, y'all remember the old Doritos commercial, you can't have just one? Like how many times is sin just a one-time thing? Y'all know what the modus operandi of sin is? More. Yeah. It has an absolute insatiable appetite. It is never, ever, ever satisfied. Like it always wants more. And I heard somebody talking about greed one time, because we're talking specifically about this sexual struggle that David had, but sin in general has this operating, you know, mode of, I just want more. So there was a man extremely, extremely wealthy to the point of greed. Like he had consumed so much that he was building bigger barns, right? Like we talked about last week. And somebody asked him, they said, how much is enough? Like when are you going to realize that you've got enough money to do whatever you want? And the man said, when I get one more dollar, that'll be enough. And then you get a dollar and one more dollar. It's always one more. It's never satisfied. And so the sin in our life, when we think maybe it's just a one-time thing, that's not how sin works. Sin always wants more, so it's never going to be satisfied. So when it becomes more and more and more, then it starts to affect the people that are around you. So we start to lie to ourselves and we say that, oh, well, this won't interfere with anyone else. This won't affect anyone else. It's just, maybe it's just in my mind, or maybe it's just this little indiscretion. And these little things always, always, always affect other people. I think you can see really clearly and quickly how in David's situation, it escalated, right? Sin is kind of like I think of it in terms of a ripple effect, right? It's small. When the rock hits the pond, it's a very small impact. Unless it's a big rock, then bigger splash, right? But a little rock. But then what happens is, even on the calmest waters, it creates ripple effects that go out several times larger than what the impact was originally. Now, sin is not even so much of a ripple effect, but a shockwave, because it's painful and it's destructive, right? So it's small in the center, but it creates all of these issues that go way further than we ever thought that it would go. So it is mad to think that your sin only affects you. The third thing is this: sin clouds our judgment to the point of being mad. Like crazy, like you have lost your mind mad. Sin clouds our judgment to the point of making us mad. So David, nobody would question that David was wrong. Would we all agree? David, that was really stupid. The sin that you committed with Bathsheba and your follow-up to that and what you did to Uriah, that was wrong. So Nathan was a prophet, and God sent Nathan to David to correct him. So this is what David said to him. And David, his judgment was so clouded that he didn't even get what was going on. We're going to look at 2 Samuel chapter 12, verses 1 through 7. It says this: the Lord sent Nathan to David. When he came to him, he said, there were two men. So Nathan's telling David a story. I love how they tell stories. It's like reading books with pictures. It's so good. There were two men in a certain town. One was rich and the other was poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, a little female lamb that he had bought. We were driving down the interstate yesterday and somebody was pulling sheep and it said U-Haul. Unbelievable. So the poor man had just this one little female sheep. The rich man had tons of sheep and tons of cattle. And the sheep that the poor man had, it says he shared his food with him. The sheep drank from his cup and even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Verse 4 says, now a traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come. So he's got all of this stuff, right? He's got all of these cattle and all these sheep. He very easily could have taken something from his stock and made a meal for the traveler. But it says, instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. So Nathan tells David this story, and David is upset. Again, David's cloud, his judgment is clouded. This is what it says about David's response. It says that David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, this dude is finna get it. He was furious. You're going to steal from the poor man, and you're the rich man, and you've got all of this stuff, and you're going to take from him who has nothing and give to him who has everything? What is wrong with you? And Nathan said, uh-oh, it's finna get real. So David says, as surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this must die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity. And Nathan said to him, it was you, bro. You're the one that took from the poor man. You're the rich man. You're the one that stole from Uriah the only thing that he had his prized possession and took it for yourself, even though you had everything that you could have ever wanted. David's judgment was so clouded in this moment. Why did it get to that point? Because of sin. Sin always messes us up, right? Like, we think that we're in control, but when sin, God, you are never, ever, ever in control when you've invited sin into your life. Like, you hand over control, you hand over the reins to the enemy. It's the concession that you make. It's like, oh, well, I guess that I'll do this. I guess that I'll allow this temptation to take fruit in my life, and I'll start to follow this path. Oh, enemy, here's the reins of my life. Do with it what you want. You're never in control when you allow sin to come into your life to that point, right? So it is mad to think that we can kind of go through this and not have it affect other people. Sin always makes us mad as far as our judgment goes. And then kind of, you know, going back to the first point, we see that the madness happens as a result of the sin that goes on in our life, right? You see that it's kind of this ripple effect, this crazy concentric circle that happens when we allow this craziness to happen. It's mad to think that you can be in the wrong place and do the right thing. It's mad to think that your sin only affects you. And it's mad as far as our judgment goes when we allow sin to get to this place in our life. But the good news is, it is mad to think that this is the end of the story. It is mad to think that sin has the final say in your life. Like, this is the good news of the gospel, right? We don't want to admit that we're sinners, although Scripture says that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. There is not one of us who is good, no, not one, right? All of these things that we read, but then we don't even want to identify as sinners. I want to identify as a sinner, because the way that Jesus tells the story, he said there were two people, they were kind of standing out in the street, and he, again, contrast, he's like, this one over here acts like he's got it all together. He's the Pharisee, and he walks into church, he's got his chest all stuck out. It's like, man, I'm pretty awesome. I go to church every week. I pay my tithes. I pitched in 20 to that Here to Stay campaign. Pretty cool. Shameless plug, right? And he's the one that looks like he's got it all together. And on the other side, Jesus says that there's this man who won't even walk up to the temple because he's so ashamed of the life that he's lived. And he kind of gets close and he looks up to the heavens and he beats his chest and he said, God, forgive me because I'm a sinner. You know which one of those that Jesus was impressed with? He wasn't impressed with Billy White Shoes. He was impressed with the man that was honest about the condition that he's in, the sin that had separated him from God, and he was begging God for his mercy. David did something that was really fascinating after he came out of this situation. You read in Psalm 51, which everybody kind of agrees, scholars agree, that this is what David wrote after Nathan confronted him, after Nathan called him out. This is what David said. Psalm 51, verses 1 and 2. He says, have mercy on me, oh God. God, have mercy on me, according to your unfailing love. According to your great compassion, blot out my transgressions, wash away all of my iniquity, and cleanse me from my sin. Y'all know what the maddest thing to do is when you've got sin in your life, you've allowed sin to come into your life and to control you? The maddest thing is to try to keep fighting that fight by yourself. The smartest thing you can do is to be like the one that Jesus was impressed with and beat your chest and look up to the heavens and say, God, forgive me. Run into the mercy and the arms of Jesus, who loves you, who has a plan for you. Who the Bible tells this story. Jesus, again, tells these wonderful stories about the prodigal son who had done everything wrong. Everything in his life up to that point was a failure. It was sinful. It was wrong. And it says that when he started to come home, that the father was waiting for him. He wasn't just waiting for him with his arms crossed and looks of disdain. Yeah, I told you you'd be back. Look what you did with everything that I gave you. Look at how you squandered the life that I've created for you. It's not what the father does. It says that the father ran to him with open arms. So, man, I don't know where you're at in your life. I don't know what struggles you've got going on. And let's not sugarcoat this, man. I don't know what sin is in your life. I don't know what struggles have gotten to the point in your life that maybe your judgment is clouded and you think, like David, that, man, maybe everybody else is struggling with this, but it's not me, right? I don't know where you're at, but what I know is that you need to run into the arms of Jesus. What I do know is that there is a God that loves you, that wants you to come to him, that begs for you. He said, come unto me. It was this cry, this plea for us to not try to keep going on our own. We're not that good. We're not built to sustain and carry the weight of sin, but there is a God who took the sin of the world upon his shoulders. And that's our responsibility, is to run to him, to turn to him. Maybe you can't even run right now. Maybe the best that you can do is just to turn to him, and that's the start. There's an old hymn. It says, turn your eyes to Jesus. Look full upon his wonderful face. And I think that's what you'll find when you get your posture, your position, you're in the wrong place, and you turn to the right place, and you see the face of Jesus. You see the love that he has for you in his eyes. Man, you'll never be the same. You're not perfect. You'll never be perfect, right? You'll never get to a place from being the wrong place to the right place. That doesn't mean a perfect place. That's not what that means. It just means that, man, you're at a different place in your life in terms of your ambitions and your passions, and you're never, ever, ever, ever going back to that wrong place. So I don't know, again, where you're at, but today is a day for some of us. And get to the right place. Get to the right place in your heart. Get to the right place in your mind. Turn your eyes upon Jesus, who absolutely loves you. He adores you. The sin that's happened in your life, the things that are in your past, all of your failures and all the shame that you've got in your life, it does not disqualify you. That is not the end of the story. In many ways, that's the beginning of your new story. Amen. Let me pray for us. Jesus, you are so good. You're so much better than we deserve. God, in all of our sin, it says that we were dead in our trespasses, separated from you entirely because of our sin. God, and your grace is so good and so real. God, it's not that we were sick people that were made well. It's that we were dead people who were made alive. And for that, we're so thankful. God, if there's anybody in the room today and their life is in shambles or their life is consumed by sin, maybe they've tried to make compromises and concessions with the enemy, thinking that it only affected them or just felt right in the moment, whatever the situation is, God, rescue them. God, pull them out of the darkness and into your marvelous light. God, you love us so much that you're not going to leave us where we are. You love us just where we are, but you're not going to leave us where we are. So, God, I pray that today would be a day of new places, that we wouldn't be comfortable staying in the wrong places any longer, but our minds and our hearts would be set towards new places, places that you want us to go, places of purpose and destiny. God, that's what you would put on our hearts. That we wouldn't be satisfied with the things of this world, that we wouldn't be satisfied with the lies that the enemy tells us, but God, we'd only be satisfied with pleasing you, with following you, with belonging to you, Jesus. We need you. Oh God, we need you. So like David, after he sinned, he said, have mercy on me, oh God. God, do that for us. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks so much for joining us for the Motion Church podcast today. If you'd like more information about our church, visit motionchurch.com. If you want to contribute financially to what God is doing here at Motion Church, you can do that by visiting motionchurch.com/giving. Thanks again for joining us. We hope you enjoyed today's message.